Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is historian and writer Derek Bang, and we're talking about Volume 2 of his thorough history, Crime and Spy Jazz on Screen Since 1971, A History and Discography. Derek, welcome back. I'm so glad to be talking to you again, especially about Volume 2, because Volume 2... although there's some sad things about jazz in movies, it really has got a lot of my favorite films in it.
And you have now come to the end of the journey. And
I hope not.
You've survived the deep dive. I'm extremely impressed.
Man, well, you know, people should know, this is not just the discography. You talk about the shows, you give a lot of background information, and there's so much to know about the artists who are playing this music. I found these books really, really sort of a great example of how discography should be done. But I want to ask you to start out. The books are divided between the sort of 50s to 1970 and then 1971 till almost today. Why the split? What was the split for in 1971?
Well, initially, this would have been one book, but it got too big, and McFarlane would have had to put a price tag on it of like $90-$95, and nobody's going to buy a $90 book. So they agreed to make it two volumes, and then the question was, well, where do we break it?
Yeah.
And if you went exactly halfway, I clocked out the pages, 1968 was the point where both volumes would have been the same number of pages. But that's such a weird, arbitrary year, and it wasn't a good year to select. And coincidentally, 1970 has that nice end of a decade, beginning of the next decade feeling. But also, the next big change came in 1971 with Isaac Hayes and Shaft.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
Which made it a very good break point.
But it's also, there's sort of a bittersweet air about this volume, because it also signals a change in the way that movies, especially, are using music. There's more attention paid to rock, which I love, and but for a jazz aficionado, that's sort of sad. And also, it's already, you're not hiring as many composers because people are using ready-made, already existing music as their scores.
And it was a combination of things. There was that, which led to what came to be known as the jukebox score. I love the quote that Mike Post had about his disdain for jukebox scores. Any fool can punch J7 and A6. That doesn't make it special.
But I happen to love them because I collect them. But from an original score point of view, you know, you're not hearing that original music anymore.
Right. And then also, of course, synths came in. Yeah. And when you have somebody... I wasn't talking about horror films, so I didn't really have an excuse to mention John Carpenter. But he did so well with his score for Halloween, just him and that keyboard, that everybody sits up and takes notice and says, well, heck, why do we have to pay all the people in an orchestra or even a jazz combo when we can just pay one guy to sit down in front of a keyboard and bang out a score?
There's also a couple of other things that were important to people who are interested in jazz and film scores, and that's entrata. Talk to me about entrata.
Oh, well, entrata was the first one of the specialty labels that started up in order to resurrect scores that had never been digitized up to that point.
Wow.
Or simply bring out debut scores that had never been released on album. When the digital revolution hit and CDs started becoming ubiquitous, you remember the shift when those nice big fat LP sections in music stores suddenly gave way to...
I was an on-the-air DJ when that happened, and it was amazing.
And of course, all that wasted packaging, because initially the CDs were in those big, long cardboard things so that they could stand up and be seen. A lot of soundtracks got left behind.
Nobody,
no big label wanted to spend the money to digitize those for the most part, unless they were really popular to begin with. So you've got an opportunity here for a niche marketing situation, and Entrada was one of the first, and Film Score Monthly followed very quickly on their heels, and we have Quartet also, and La La Land, and they do such a wonderful job of reviving these scores, not merely bringing them back, but the CD package comes with, in many cases, a very thick booklet explaining the music by a scholar who either knows that particular score very well or went back and did his own deep dive and picked up a whole lot of information. And in a lot of cases, you don't just get, in the case of an album that's been revived that was never digitized, you don't just get the soundtrack as it was released on an album, because in many cases, remember, those are re-recordings. You also get, it's paired on the same CD, since they have room for both sets of music, with the original score cues.
Wow.
So you can compare the track as it would lay down, say, by Elmer Bernstein, with the way he later reorchestrated it in order to make it a more listener-friendly album.
Now, this is also, this volume, as I mentioned, has some of my favorite films and TV shows, and I'm going to skip around a lot. Because there's so much to read about in this book. But I want to talk about the TV show. There was sort of a whole era of odd detective shows. Canon with William Conrad. And you know, the weird thing is, I didn't really watch it a lot when it first came out, but now it's in rerun on MeTV. So I've been watching, it comes on like at 4 o'clock in the morning, so I get up and it's appointment television. And it really is a funny, I think unintentionally, but I think it's a pretty funny detective show, because he really doesn't get around too fast.
No, no. It was the 80s. Actually, it started in the late 70s, but yes, it really peaked in the 80s, where we had the eccentric detectives. Cannon was overweight. We had the geezer detectives, you know, Barnaby Jones.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the ones who were old and... there was a whole slew of them, and they lent themselves to a lot of very engaging
themes. Well, Canon's an interesting example, though, because there were originally two different themes.
Right.
Talk to me about that.
In the case of Canon, it was the same theme, but it was reorchestrated. The composer used a jazz tuba to mimic William Conrad's movements, and Conrad didn't like that. He thought the music was poking fun at him, and so he didn't really have the clout, apparently, when the show initially went on the air, to do anything about it. But once it became popular, he was, forgive me for what I'm about to say, able to throw his weight around a little bit more.
I can't believe you went there.
The main theme was rescored with a flute, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So you didn't have that tuba swagger anymore, which is really a shame, because honestly, the original version was much better.
Yeah, and I think it really fit the show more, because the show really seems odd when you're watching it, and I think the tuba really worked.
Yeah,
now, by the way, I want to give William Conrad always the props for doing the narration of Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Are you kidding? That voice? Oh,
I know.
Talk about voices that are born for radio. He sure had one.
Now, you know, I recently did a show inspired entirely by your volumes, a rock show, Positive Noise, about detective and spy music. And it was the first time I got to mention Lalo Schifrin on a rock show. And Lalo Schifrin ended up teaming up with Clint Eastwood during this time period.
They did a lot of stuff together.
I found that fascinating.
It actually started, I'm trying to remember, what was their first one?
Dirty Harry, I think.
No, Coogan's Bluff, I believe.
Okay. That's not part of that series, the Dirty Harry series.
No, yeah. No. They did four of the five Dirty Harry movies together. Schifrin had to bow out for the third one, The Enforcer, because he was otherwise occupied at the time, which was okay because Jerry Fielding came in and delivered a terrific jazz score for that one. And, they did a lot of movies together, and Schifrin was responsible for what became the very well-recognized two pieces of music, two score cues that we now think of when we watch the Dirty Harry films. The action cue, if you will, that he debuted in the first film when Harry's on the roof looking back at where the sniper was when he fired on the woman who was in the swimming pool at the top of a building next door. It's a very, very percussive, jangly, nervous cue. And then the melancholy cue, which is kind of the elegy that you hear at the end of the first movie. And as that cue became better developed in the subsequent films, Schifrin got a lyricist and turned it into a vocal, which is how the fifth film uses that particular piece of music. And that fascinates me. I'm intrigued when a piece of music that starts out in one format, say an instrumental cue, kind of not exactly a throwaway cue, but not necessarily the most important piece of music in a film, and it evolves and it becomes more important, and then somebody sits down and puts lyrics to it and it turns into a song.
Now, Schifrin also worked with Bruce Lee in Enter the Dragon, didn't he?
Yes, and oh, isn't that an iconic score? That's a soundtrack which really stays with you. And you talk about music which immediately evokes the film or TV show for which it was originally written, and Enter the Dragon, Schifrin's score for that film, definitely does that. Oh, that propulsive, pounding, action-oriented title theme is unforgettable.
Yeah. You have so many interesting sort of asides that you write about, and this is what I want to emphasize to the audience. This is not a dry, encyclopedic accounting of these scores at all. There's a lot in there. It was interesting reading your notes about the conversation, the Coppola film with Harry Call, and there's the scoring in that, and then he plays jazz sax in that.
Yes, he does.
But it's interesting what you say about that.
Now, the score was by David Shire,
who
was new to the business at that point in time, and he kind of came in it in a family way, if you will, because he was married to Coppola's sister, Talia Shire, at the time, and was around when the film was being proposed and Coppola was figuring out, you know, what he wanted to do. And he gave Shire a very interesting assignment. He said, I'm going to give you five bits of information about Harry Call, and I want you to take each one of those pieces of information and write a little theme that you think evokes that sense of Harry Call. And when you're done, bring them back. And Shire did this, and Coppola liked one of them, and that became the film's primary theme. Now, there are two styles of music in the film. David Shire's score is basically just keyboard.
Right.
And that doesn't happen very often. And it's used to evoke the precision of Harry Call's character and the meticulousness with which he approaches his surveillance job. And then, yes, as you mentioned, on his off hours, when Harry relaxes, he plays jazz sax to record albums.
But he really can't riff.
No, he can't, because he's too technical oriented.
That's right.
He can't relax. And so the sax that he plays to these records sounds, sterile?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the cleverness of the film is, as the story progresses, Harry Call begins to fear that he himself is being surveyed and watched. And the further he succumbs to paranoia, the more discordant and jagged and grotesque his efforts on the sax. He can no longer play it at all. All he can do is, you know, make blatty noises, and of course the horrific, gruesome final sequence of the film.
He's torn apart his entire apartment.
Right.
And he's sitting there virtually, in his underwear playing the sax.
Looking for bugs that he can't find.
Yeah.
And the whole place is torn apart, and so he's standing or sitting there mournfully blapping on the sacks, and the lights go down, and you know the poor guy has absolutely lost his mind.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is historian and writer Derek Bang, and we're talking about Volume 2 of his thorough history, Crime and Spy Jazz on Screen Since 1971, a history and discography. So we're talking about, this is the second volume. There are so many interesting stories about the scoring of these films. There was an interesting story about The Getaway, and that the original score was dumped. McQueen didn't like it.
No, it was Jerry Fielding, I believe.
Yep, it was.
And everybody loved what Jerry Fielding did, including the director, Sam Peckinpah. And McQueen didn't, and nobody knows why. That is a question that has never been answered to anybody's satisfaction. I guess McQueen just didn't feel that the music fit the film. So, this isn't even the 11th hour. It's the 11 and three-quarterth hour. He demands that the music be changed. So Quincy Jones gets brought in, and given one of a film composer's nightmare assignments, because at this point in time, the film print is locked.
Wow.
It cannot be re-edited. So Jones had to score specifically in the same spots that Fielding had previously inserted the music. He couldn't change anything. And that's got to be awful.
It has to be.
That's got to be awful. And the nifty thing, historically looking back, is that Fielding's score has been released. So you can play it.
So what do you think about it? I've never heard it. Is Quincy Jones' score better? That's the bottom line.
I think it works in the film better.
Okay.
I love Jerry Fielding's music. Don't get me wrong here. And composers get replaced all the time. That in itself isn't unusual. What was unusual in this particular case is that it happened so late in the game. Fielding's score is more feathery. It's not as tense. He was clearly playing more to the romantic aspect of the story, where McQueen's character and his wife, played by Ally McGraw, they start off on rocky footing at the beginning of the film, and after going through everything that they go through, you know they're going to be okay as a couple. And Fielding clearly went for that aspect of the storyline, say the emotional content, whereas Jones goes, his score has a tougher, I hate to use this word, more masculine aspect, and it clearly follows the dangerous action oriented aspect of the storyline. So, apples and oranges. I wouldn't say either one of them was right or wrong. They're just different.
You're being political there.
Not intentionally.
Okay. Now we got to talk about Shaft. Isaac Hayes and Shaft. That soundtrack. I when that came out, I mean, that was revolutionary. It was a phenomenon.
Oh, it was a total game changer. And it's funny. I have taken a bit of heat from some people for including it in the book.
Really? Well, you know what those people can do.
they say, that's not jazz, man. That's funk. I say, oh, come on, please.
Funk jazz. Funk slash jazz.
Semantics. On top of which, even if I were to acknowledge, which I won't, that Oscar-winning title theme isn't quite jazz, which I think it is, if you sit down and play the double album set, my God, of course it's jazz.
Right, exactly right. Now, I heard a weird story about the lyrics to that. He realized he wasn't going to get an Oscar unless there were lyrics. He had originally written it as an instrumental, and he had like just a half hour left. He was rushing to the studios in the back of a limo with a couple of the classic women that would hang around him, and he just like literally ripped off the lyrics in a matter of minutes.
Why not?
That's exactly why I actually have that on good.
And it's true.
You had to have lyrics in order to win the, I think, the Oscar for the best song or something.
Well, right, because then if you don't have lyrics, it's not a song.
That's right. So
it's a cue.
He decided to just rip them off on the way. He was like, "Wait, I'm going to do this," and he just did it on the way, and it was just amazing.
Imagine that he was evoking the spontaneity of the beats of the 1950s.
That's exactly right.
And anticipating the spontaneities of the rappers to come.
And he was so good at that because he had been writing for such a long time for other people. And that album was a bestseller. I mean, that was
album was beyond a bestseller.
It was huge. I mean, to this day, you hear those first notes and you just get into that groove. It's like amazing.
Oh, I know. Don't you love those? There are some pieces of music where you only need the first, 5 seconds?
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right.
What it is. I mean, when I hear that first hanging note at the beginning of the Pink Panther theme by Manfred.
That's right. It's exactly right.
You immediately know what's coming. If you're going to get that doot, 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 doot.
Now let's talk about Chinatown.
Oh.
Jerry Goldsmith. Yeah. Now, did I misread you, or did you say that wasn't jazz?
It almost didn't make the cut. It almost didn't make the cut.
You actually write that? You didn't think that was really jazz?
The bulk of the score is orchestral.
You're right.
And texture.
But the theme.
But that main theme, it's got that mournful horn.
Oh, my God.
And I had to include it.
The main theme is, again, another classic. It's like one of those things that sets the tone and the mood for the entire film.
It does. And that's one of the films that opens on... kind of Art Deco credits, an Art Deco background, and it's a simple text on this artistic wallpaper background, if you will, and you've got this lonely, lazy, mournful horn, and you just know that whatever's coming is not going to end well.
You know, we should talk about I'm trying to jam so much information here because this book is so full of stuff. The James Bond films. Diamonds Are Forever, and you're right, that was the last spy jazz Bond film.
The last classic spy jazz
Bond
film.
And it wasn't that great a film.
No, it's kind of a cartoon. I always felt that Diamonds Are Forever was the first Roger Moore Bond film.
Oh, wow.
Come on.
I totally agree, but I'm so glad you said it and I didn't have to.
I mean... You know, again, don't get me wrong.
For me,
Sean Connery will always be James Bond.
Yeah,
so
me
I gotta
too.
I got to say that Daniel Craig is running
close
second.
Yes. But Shirley Bassey again. John Barry.
That wonderfully sexy theme.
Yeah, I know.
That co-producer Harry Saltzman hated because he thought it was too dirty.
Oh, my God. That was the best thing about the film.
Yeah, and that soundtrack went through an interesting process when it turned into a record album, because there is some great classic John Barry driving Bond, James Bond driving jazz music in that film, but when United Artists sat down to put the album together, they focused on the film's Las Vegas-y lounge cocktail music, which infuriated Barry. Because he felt it did not accurately represent the film. And so he must have been delighted years and years and years later when when the album was remastered and we got a much better sense of the entire score as he had written it with a great deal of music that wasn't on the original LP.
Before we leave, I need to talk about The Long Goodbye because that's one of my favorite film scores because it's so bizarre.
It's a strange film to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
Robert Altman is an eclectic director at best. When he's on, his films are brilliant. And when he's not, they're just weird.
I think this film is on. It is weird that it takes place in sort of the hippie 60s.
Yeah, I mean...
But the idea for the music is crazy. I love the soundtrack album to this.
You bring Philip Marlowe into the hippie era. You know, he's living next door to a bunch of women who like to exercise in the nude on the balcony
and do hash brownies.
Right, and do hash brownies. And so, this was one of John Williams' reasonably early scores, certainly pre-Jaws. And Altman had this strange idea. He said, you know, I want this one piece of music. I want to have a running theme. And whether it's part of the background non-diegetic score or whether it's source music that you hear, like when you walk into a store over the PA system or something, I want it to be this same piece of music so that no matter what's going on, you feel like you're hearing the same thing. And it's spooky. So the camera tracks on Marlowe, Elliot Gould, as, say, he walks down a street and you're hearing non-diegetic background music, you know, classic score, and he walks into a store, and without missing a beat, the same tune is being played over the PA system. So Williams supplied several different versions of the tune himself, and then he hired a bunch of other people, including Dave Grusin, as I recall, right, had a combo version of it, to provide these alternate readings, these distinctly different presentations of the same piece of music.
Who wrote the lyrics? Was it Arlen?
Boy, you got me there.
You had it in the book. It's a famous tunester. And there is a song there. It's a long goodbye.
Right.
And you just hear it throughout the movie until the very, very end.
Yeah, and it does have an intriguingly hypnotic effect on the presentation of the story within the film.
One of the things I learned among many in this book is that Elmer Bernstein did the title theme to the Mod Squad.
Oh, isn't that unexpected?
I was totally unexpected. And not only that,
he scored
a dozen episodes.
Oh, hang on. No, Earl Hagen did the Mod Squad.
Okay.
Elmer Bernstein did SWAT.
SWAT, okay. But didn't he also score a couple of episodes? Are you sure? Because I thought I read that he wrote the Mod Squad theme.
No, that was Earl Hagen.
Okay, all right.
And that's another great theme that was a lot of fun for Hagen to put together because it had to be syncopated to that title sequence with the three stars running down that darkened alleyway.
Now, what's happening today for TV shows? First of all, some of these great composers are still alive and they could be composing.
Lalo Schifrin still with us,
right,
for example.
Right, right.
Money really is the root of all evil. As we moved into the turn of the century, the commercial content in a typical hour-long TV show got so large that the showrunners, the writers, they didn't want to sacrifice the 30 seconds, 45 seconds, 60 seconds that it took to have a title sequence. So you started seeing shows where there was no credit sequence. The credits would just appear over the action in the first act.
Right.
And of course, if you do that,
you'd already be in the action, and then you'd see the credits rolling.
Right, and if you do that, you have no title theme.
Yeah, it's amazing.
The writing was on the wall, and Mike Post knew this when he came along to do Law and Order. I mean, the only piece of music in that film is that bong bong.
Exactly.
And that's it. No, that's not a theme.
No.
and this has become ubiquitous. And actually, thank God for the new content on streaming platforms because they're bringing back title sequences.
We're going to have to run. We're actually running late. My returning guest tonight is historian and writer Derek Bang, and we're talking about Volume 2 of his thorough history, Crime and Spy Jazz on Screen Since 1971, A History and Discography. I think these are must-have volumes. Derek, it's a pleasure as always.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.